Hi everyone, we have a special announcement before we begin this week's episode. Have you ever wished that you could walk around a city and be given a private, intimate tour whispered into your ears in a sultry tone by a celebrity expert guide?
All the time. Yeah.
Well, that dream is now a reality if you're visiting London. Ooh. Because QI has teamed up with VoiceMap, a brilliant self-guided tour app to bring you the first quite interesting tours, packed full of our trademark unusual facts.
And narrated by none other than Mr. QI himself, Sir Stephen Fry.
Whoa. Yeah. You simply download the app from the Apple Store or Google Play, select your tour, stick your headphones in, and get walking.
It's really easy to use. You can put your phone away because VoiceMap monitors your location as you're on the move, and it plays audio to you automatically as you arrive at each location. So it's great. You don't need to check your phone the whole time.
You can do it whenever you like, and like start whenever, stop, have a drink, halfway through.
Do it at 3 a.m. if you're interested.
Creepy.
We've got good street lights here in London, so you know, you'll be able to see everything. We've put two London tours together so far, one of Westminster and one of the City and Bankside.
That's right. So whether you're a first-time visitor to London or a lifetime local, you can take directions from Stephen and see the city from a whole new perspective. For example, did you know that
London is home to over 8.4 million trees, covering 21% of the city? This means that by the UN's standards, it can officially be classified as a forest.
That's so cool. I didn't know that.
I feel so healthy now.
Yeah. Or did you know that our most famous landmark, Big Ben,
keeps accurate time with the help of a handful of pre-decimal coins? A single penny balanced on the pendulum can speed the clock up by 2/5 of a second.
Who uses cash these days?
Yeah, only our clocks.
Well, yeah, only our clocks. That's where it all is.
You might discover how
London's classic red phone boxes were actually based on a tomb.
Oh, they do look quite like a tomb, actually.
So, what's not to love? To get started, just visit qi.com/voicemap.
If you're not going to be in London anytime soon, you can still get involved. You can listen to the tours virtually, just like a podcast or audiobook.
But before you crack into that, make sure you enjoy this week's episode of Lunchbox Envy.
Hey.
This week on Lunchbox Envy, we only eat about 10% of what we grow.
We've been growing it for 9,000 years.
And without us, it has no way of surviving.
It's corn. Hello and welcome to Lunchbox Envy. I am Rosie McKean. I'm a food writer and chef, and I'm joined today by two of the loveliest people in the world, QI elves, Alex and Jack.
Aww, oh,
that's
hello,
very
Rosie,
sweet.
Thank
intro.
You. How are you today?
That's okay. It's just because I wasn't reading the script.
I usually write quite a neutral introduction. Yeah. Rosie embellishes it.
Yes, I'm very well, thank you. I'm actually reeling from one of the best sauces of my life that I ate this week.
Wow.
A couple of friends of mine recently travelled to Mozambique, where peri peri sauce comes from, i.e. Nando's peri peri sauce, i.e. Portuguese African sauce. They very sweetly brought us back a bottle of peri peri sauce, and my God, it is absolutely amazing. Like, I've never tried anything like it. It's really ruined normal peri peri sauce for me. And the thing is it's from Mozambique, so it's going to run out, and I'm not going to be able to get any more unless I go back.
We've got nearly 28,000 followers on Instagram. We could just, you know, I'm sure at some point someone's flying to Mozambique. They could bring
someone
us back.
If anyone's listening and is got a trip booked to Mozambique soon, could you please pick up a bottle of peri peri?
We should set up, the legacy of this podcast should be an international source exchange.
Oh my God.
Yeah, that's a nice idea.
In a very similar vein, I've been enjoying some unhomogenized Channel Islands milk. Actually.
Can I just say that seems so out of character for you? Because you love homogenized things.
I actually did. Such a slam.
Are you being homophobic?
I am.
Yes. I'm not.
Homogenophobic.
So, corn. I mean, listen, corn feels like that's quite a broad strokes term for a very big group of things.
Yes, people tend to prefer maize to distinguish, because corn has been used historically to describe the local ubiquitous cereal. So if it's, you know, Scotland, it might be oats. If it's France, it might be wheat.
Really?
And that's where the term comes from, is colonists being all, you know, highfalutin, saw this maize growing, and they saw the indigenous Americans growing it, and so they referred to it as Indian corn. And that got shortened to corn.
I see.
And then because of the proliferation of English, specifically American English, it's become known as corn around the world. But it should kind of technically be called maize. But the true American name, as in pre-English, pre-Columbian, the Taino people and the Arawakans had a word that is basically maíz.
Right.
And then Linnaeus came along and classified, he was the guy who invented the Latin binomials for everything. And he described it as Zea Maize. So maize is basically its official name.
And it is from the Americas?
Yeah. It's come from Central America.
Okay.
So that side of the Columbian Exchange. It was actually first domesticated 7,000 years before Common Era, so a long time ago, from a wild version. And then, it slowly spread north to what is now Arizona about 4,000 years ago. And then by 900 Common Era, so we're talking 1,000 years ago, Native Americans were farming it. And we know that because there was a decline in both forest cover and the native freshwater mussel population.
Oh.
So archaeologists noticed that there were way fewer mussel shells from the year 900, basically, to present. And they know that these freshwater mussels are very sensitive to environmental changes. And so they theorized and they worked out that that must have been because they were sort of clearing forests and getting rid of wildlife in order to grow maize.
Disturbing the ecosystem.
Yeah, disturbing the ecosystem.
I see. And were they using maize at that time exclusively as a foodstuff? Or was it as it is now, kind of a bit more broad?
Yeah, it was exclusively food stuff. I mean, you might feed it to your livestock.
So we should say now, like, the majority of what we grow now goes, 60% goes on animals.
Does it?
Yeah. The overall statistics are, of all different types of corn that we grow, and we eat about 10% of it, about 15% of it we turn into biofuels, like with ethanol and stuff like that.
Really?
And then 60% goes towards animal feed. So this is mostly to feed animals that we then eat.
And so...
So we do eat it, actually, eventually.
But in varying different forms.
With extra steps.
But sweet corn is a genus of corn. It's a species.
Yes, it's a specific
variety. But actually, like, for example, in Mexico, which I'm going to talk about quite a lot... They don't really eat sweet corn.
No.
They weigh so many different types of heirloom corns.
Yeah. Mm.
And sweet corn is the stuff that we know, which is yellow, tiny kernels, you know, small cob.
Yeah, it's kind of like if someone wasn't used to wheat, except via fairy cakes. And they were like, did you know 99% of wheat doesn't go into fairy cakes?
That's so true.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's... astonishing how much corn we produce as a globe. So together with wheat and rice, it provides half the total calories consumed by humans.
Wow.
So those three, basically wheat, rice and corn, half our calories. Corn is the most produced of the three, 1.1 billion tonnes annually, second only to sugar cane in terms of total tonnage produced by the world.
Wow.
And it's actually the one crop that the USA beats China at. Because usually it's China that's the world, just because it's got the biggest population, second biggest now, but like a lot more land, a lot of industrialized farming. But actually the USA is more than China.
Wow.
I noticed you've got an AI picture on your notes of some corn driving down an American coastline on a Harley Davidson.
Yeah.
I really love when you guys have little pictures on your notes as if to sort of like...
It's like a memory aid. Yeah.
Would you like the picture I've got on mine, Rosie? Which is, it's what I think of when I think of corn, which is an iconic stock photo called Cyberwoman with Corn. And it's like emblematic of the most insane niche random stock photos that were out there in the golden age of like stock photography.
Photos,
it's so good. A woman wearing a Star Trek visor.
She's like, in a silver spandex body tight suit.
She honestly looks like something I would have worn to like a uni Halloween party.
Give it a Google if you don't know what I'm talking about. There's a whole shoot of like Cyberwoman in enjoying different vegetables and doing different things with the vegetable.
Okay.
So
Cyberwoman is such a funny concept. Look, what's she doing? She's
Cyberwoman
painting it.
Injecting corn, Cyberwoman sleeping next to some other vegetables.
Alex, I can see on your notes there you have some different types.
Yeah, should we go through some of the main types of corn that we grow? So dent corn. That's the one that's mainly used for like animal feed and things. It's not really one that we eat very much.
Okay.
It's named because I think when the kernel dries, it has like a dent in it. So right. It's called dent corn. Then there's one called flint corn, one of the types of which is Indian corn. And that's got a really hard outer shell. It comes in lots of different colors. Quite common in South America, mm-hmm. parts of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Flour corn. Very soft and starchy, easy to grind. Used a lot in the Americas to create corn flour.
Mm-hmm.
Pod corn,
oh,
which is all
the one we have on the
podcast, one we're eating right now. Yeah, ha ha ha. So that's when each kernel is enclosed in its own like husk, and yeah. It's not really useful for very much.
Right.
Yeah, that would take like a lot of faff. But that's it is beans,
exactly. But it is thought that might be closer to what the more ancient maize was.
Oh,
really?
Yeah. Then you've got sweet corn. Yay. Shout out to the corn, famous.
And we've been
the famous ones that we recognise, yeah. And then my favourite, popcorn.
Hey.
Surely not a type of corn.
No, it is.
Absolutely. Wait until my lunchbox, Rosie.
Okay.
So those are kind of the main types, I would say.
Yeah. Okay. I found one called glass gem corn,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of the poster child of growing unsung varieties and, you know, heirloom. Mm-hmm. Not monocultures. Basically, it's beautiful. Do Google it if you have a chance. Each kernel is a different colour and it just looks like a jewel. It's Ooh. Beautiful.
To be clear, when you talk about a corn as like an ingredient, I suppose, you have the husk, which is the shell, the sort of funny fibrous leaves yeah. and stuff. Then you've got the kernels, which are the individual sort of, what are they? Are they seeds? Are they fruits?
Fruit.
Are they? Oh, she got it second time round.
Yeah, they're monoecious, so they self-pollinate. And the male bits are called the tassels, and they're the flowery bits that you often mm-hmm. see on top. And then the cobs are the female bit, and they're called ears.
Nice. Oh. And so the cob is basically the very dense, starchy, tough centre, which the kernels are all attached to. Yeah.
And the whole thing's an ear.
That you scrape off or you use your teeth to bite off.
Which I think that's one. I'm not a huge fan of sweet corn. I don't really love the taste. I'll eat it when there's sweet corn in the dish, but eating it off the cob, I just get very worried that it's going to break my teeth.
It is quite tough on the old teeth. You can get quite a lot in it. And I'm going to warn you now, you're about to eat some corn on the cob.
I know, but I'm going to do so very delicately and I'll nibble at it like a squirrel.
I've seen a video of a French guy just like sat at a desk and he gets a drill and then a corn on the cob and he puts the corn on the cob on the drill and just
that will result in a trip to the dentist. Yeah. No.
So have you ever counted the kernels on your cob?
Obviously not, but I bet you have as a child. Clearly.
I have a life.
No, but they almost always contain an even number of rows because of how they grow.
Oh, yeah.
So finding one with an odd number of rows is like, I mean, it's basically mutated. It's like finding a four-leaf clover.
It reminds me a bit of how nearly all of us have an even number of teeth. But then some people have an odd number with one big central tooth in the middle.
Like Tom Cruise.
What?
Look at Tom Cruise's face. He's got one big tooth in the middle.
Yeah.
On his top or bottom?
Top, I think, yeah.
Yeah, when he smiles.
Surely not.
Yeah, no. It's probably quite good for eating corn for cob.
Yeah.
Scrape with that one, they won't get stuck in between your teeth.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Have you heard of corn smut?
Yes, I have.
Have you?
Well, why do you
deliver
it
every day
I
on this
have.
Podcast, don't you?
Corny smut.
This is
wheat la coche.
Wheat la coche.
Yeah.
Oh my
it
God.
Is. So it's actually a fungal pathogen.
Yeah.
So it's a disease that infects maize.
Yeah.
And what happens is that this fungus gets inside the kernels and it kind of causes them to swell into these like bulbous, bluey grey kind of like things.
They look quite a lot like The Last of Us mutants.
Yeah. Yes, they do.
It looks very diseasey.
I bet they were inspired by that. The designers of The Last of Us.
I suppose you could almost maybe say truffly, given that
they are called, translated as corn truffles sometimes.
Right. Okay. So they are eaten as a delicacy, especially in Mexico. The flavour is apparently like earthy and smoky and quite mushroom-like, which makes a lot of sense. And you know, you can find them in quesadillas and soups and tamales.
Yeah, a wheat la coche quesadilla is delicious.
But yeah, I mean, obviously they're a disease that can infect and destroy whole crops on the one hand, if you're trying to grow maize.
Oh, I see.
So some farmers will want to avoid it and try and get rid of it if they have it.
Mm.
But then like another farm, they might be intentionally growing it to sell as delicacy, which is kind of interesting.
It's a great sort of innovation of humans to be like, I wonder if we can eat this.
Try and eat everything.
It's
definitely one of those words though that obviously I think must have like maybe Nahuatl
origins,
which is the Mesoamerican people. I genuinely was like, that's made up. There's no way it's a real word. Like, that doesn't make any sense.
The English version of corn smart sounds like it's been made up as well, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yes. It's what you find on Corn Hub.
Hardcore quant snap.
Oh, God. Okay, right. It is time for our first lunchbox, and I'm thrilled to say it's mine. ¿Has estado en México?
Excuse me.
Have you guys ever been to Mexico?
No, I have not. No.
No.
Right. Mexico is what I'm going to talk about today. And we're going to talk about elotes.
Elotes.
So these are sometimes called Mexican street corn.
Okay.
There are actually two types of Mexican, well, there's multiple types of Mexican street corn, but the specific most popular two are elotes, which are these corns on the cob, mm-hmm. and yep. esquites, which is corn in a cup.
Okay. And you're saying street corn, not sweet corn.
Street corn. Happens nice. To be sweet because we're in the UK, but it is in fact street. So basically vendors will sell you these delicious boiled corn cobs, and they are then... Oh, I'm going to show you what they have. Yeah, okay. So every dish.
Oh, she's cracked the mayo out.
It's smeared in mayonnaise. So you smear it on the mayonnaise.
Yeah.
Then in Mexico, this is not quite right. I'm using feta today, but you would actually use a different type of queso, cotija.
Okay, so you're sprinkling the feta all the way around because you're using the mayo as an adhesive.
Yeah. So basically, what you're doing is you're coating your corn.
This is very art attack.
And then you sprinkle it with chili.
Ooh, look at that.
Lovely. Have you been to Mexico, Rosie?
I have, and it was one of the best trips of my entire life.
I now feel like I've been.
Right. Wow, that is your elote.
That's beautiful.
Incredible.
There we go. Elote's a clock.
Mm. Oh, listen to that crunch.
Oh, that heaven. Anything smeared with mayonnaise gets a big 10 out of 10 from me. So... basically, the word elote, which is what in Mexican Spanish means corn on the cob, mm-hmm. actually comes from the Nahuatl word elotitul for tender cob. Almost always they're sold from like little food carts. They're called eloteros. And you will either get, some vendors will actually sell you a choice of really hard or really soft corn kernels. And also they will potentially use like heirloom corn varieties. The best one, if you can get it, is... maíz cacao. Oh God, I'm about to butcher a lot of Nahuatl words, and I just want anyone who is Mexican to know that
I've
tried my best. It's called maíz cacahuazintl, which is a heirloom variety of white dent corn, which comes from the Valley of Toluca, which is in central Mexico. And it is extremely popular for its large, round and very starchy white kernels. And they basically kind of blossom like flowers when they're cooked. And they're actually they're most popular in the Mexican soup pozole, which is like a corn soup. But they're also really good for elotes. And basically, they're boiled and then kept hot, either in water or in a brazier. Sometimes they'll also then grill them for you. But most of the time, you just buy them boiled. And they smear them with all your toppings, your mayonnaise, your queso and your chile. And then... there you go. Off you go. You're about to get the most corn stuck in your teeth of your entire life, but it is damn good. And esquites are actually slightly different because it's essentially a lot of the same ingredients. So you've got corn, but it's off the cob. It's been boiled, and then quite often it's like sautéed with onions and butter or lard.
Okay.
And then it's shoved in a cup with a bit of its like broth. Yeah. And then it's topped with like lime, chili, mayonnaise. What I like about both of these things is the quantity of mayonnaise. As I told you, like when you get a cup of esquites, they literally just put like a whole massive scoop of mayonnaise on top. And it is iconic because I love mayonnaise. But it's essentially like you cannot do an episode on corn without talking about Mexico.
Yeah,
because
very true.
So much of Mexican food culture comes from corn. Mm. And of course, one of the most popular exports of Mexican food is the taco and tortillas, which are the fundamental ingredient.
Oh, yeah.
The most commonly found is our corn tortillas. And the word for taco originated potentially from Mexican silver mines because miners used to use the term taco to describe the little paper-wrapped explosive charges would stick into
the walls,
caves.
Yeah, like the fishes to blow them up.
And then because a rolled tortilla with fillings, because quite often, actually, we don't really do it in this country, but if you make a taco, you roll it up.
Yeah.
really look like this wrapped stick of dynamite. Yeah, yeah. That's why they got called tacos.
And may it result in an explosion down the line.
Yeah. Well, yes. But also mine workers were taking food like tacos down the mines. There is a specific type of taco, which is nowadays called tacos de canasta, which is basically tacos that are already made and stacked very tightly so that they stay hot in a basket. And they're quite sweaty and there's like broth and stuff on them. So they're not as we British people know tacos to be. But basically they would make those a sort of similar style of taco for the mine so that all the men could have a nice hot meal when they were down the mine.
Bring for a lot of, what oh, a no, terrible. That's my lunch over there. What am I eating?
So the unique thing about corn, so I guess I should actually start this with a question. Have you ever tried to make a corn tortilla?
No.
Do you know about me, Rosie?
No. So a corn tortilla is made from corn, but it's made from corn kernels. It's not made from cornmeal. You literally cannot use cornmeal as we know it, the dried cornmeal that we can buy in packets in the supermarket.
Yeah.
It's not got enough starch in it.
Oh,
you can't make a dough from that.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I didn't.
You actually have to make it from nixtamalized corn. So basically nixtamalization is the soaking of the and boiling of the corn in a lime solution.
Oh.
Lime, not being the fruit, it's actually food grade lime, which is calcium hydroxide. It's also known as slaked lime or pickling lime, right? You soak and boil your corn in this alkaline solution and you leave it overnight to make what is then called nixtamal, which is nixtamalized corn. Then they grind it through a grinder with some extra water going through it to make this masa, basically, this which is the word for dough.
Right.
And
have you ever nixtamalized?
I have not, but I have been to Mexico City and sort of like looked through windows into this is really approximate like association to food, isn't it? I've seen it through a window.
Put your 10 peso coin in a little flap over, you get 30 seconds watch two people nixtamalizing.
But basically, it's like this incredibly unique process that actually was invented by the Aztecs, the Nahuatl people, to make another dish, not to make tacos, not to make tortillas. It was to make tamales.
Oh.
Have you ever had a tamal?
No, but I've heard people raving about them.
They're very good. So basically a tamal is masa made from the nixtamalized corn, stuffed with vegetables, meat. In the olden days, it was purely vegetables and herbs, but now you might find queso, you might find meat, you might find veg. And then it is wrapped in corn husk, or sometimes it's also wrapped in plantain leaves, banana leaves. And then you steam them for a really long time and they become these little pockets of food and they were very portable. Yeah.
But what's interesting is the European colonists didn't bother to learn about nixtamalization.
No.
So when they brought corn back, they had all these problems in Europe specifically where people were eating too much corn. As in, poor people would have it as their main source of calories. Mm. And they were suffering from vitamin B deficiencies, which is known as pellagra. It's a horrible disease defined by the four Ds.
Death?
Death is the last
one. Death.
Diarrhea.
The first one is dermatitis.
Okay.
So if it appears as rashes on your skin, then you get diarrhea. Then you get dementia. It's like sending you mad.
Jesus.
I know, that's a bit of a step up, right? Diarrhea to dementia.
Yeah.
And then the fourth one is death.
God, that's a horrible combination.
Yeah. So it's pretty horrible.
I'm pretty sure there was a town in Italy, potentially in like the Dolomites in the Veneto,
another D,
that really suffered from this disease, like because they were eating so much polenta, potentially during the war because they couldn't get any other stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So basically, corn does contain niacin, which is the common word for vitamin B3, but it's not bioavailable until you nixtamalize it. So the silly colonialists didn't realize this. And thousands of people would have died. And it wasn't until 1914 that someone worked out that it was to do with this nutrient deficiency. So nowadays it's not so much of a problem because people have a way more mixed diet. You don't really get people who survive off
or
polenta alone.
Stuff, yeah.
But also we grow high lysine maize, which is basically sort of selectively bred version of corn, which, I mean, it's complicated, but lysine's basically the precursor to making niacin in your body.
Right. So it's just,
So it's hard to get pellagra now. You have to really try.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank God, because I was a bit worried, because I do eat a lot of polenta.
We've been sneaking vitamin B supplements into your mayonnaise, so you're fine.
Yes, thank God.
You're in danger of overdosing.
Anyway, the word nixtamalization, of course, comes from Nahuatl, and it is from two words, nextli, which means ashes or lime. And you can actually make lime from ash. So some like really bougie, really high-end, like Michelin restaurants in America will be like, these are our homemade ash blue corn tortillas. So they make their own lime from their own ashes.
That was a very good M&S ad-lib which you just did.
Yeah. Thank you. I've been practicing. Like, bow, bow, bow. Get in touch for voiceover opportunities.
This is not just mayonnaise.
This is not just ash. And then, the other Nahuatl word is tamali, which means like a uniformed maize dough.
Okay, so right. Nix tamal.
Nix tamal.
Oh my God, yeah, it makes sense now.
Yeah, so all of these words are, you know, very much unique to Nahuatl language.
I think it shot right up to one of my favourite words on the pod. Yeah.
It's great.
Great word.
It's also got an X and a Z in it.
Yeah.
Oh, great for Scrabble.
Great for Scrabble.
Yeah. So
British
don't
Scrabble.
Feel bad if you've ever given it a really red hot crack to make tortillas from cornmeal. It doesn't contain any starch. You have to nixtamalize the corn to get that starchiness to make even something that will resemble a dough.
Right.
Yeah.
So you couldn't make it from polenta.
Yeah.
You just couldn't.
Once again, I'm walking away from this podcast less inspired to try new foods and new cooking.
You live above a Mexican restaurant.
Yeah, I know. I literally live for, yeah.
I did want to touch briefly on maybe more of a British angle here, the tinned corn, the tinned sweet corn.
Oh, yeah.
Ho, ho, ho. Green giant.
Lovely stuff.
We eat a lot of tinned corn in this country. Mm. And I thought, a bit like when I was talking about peas and frozen peas and sort of the virtues of...
As we venture ever closer to the apocalypse, people need to be thinking about how they're going to cook in their bunkers.
You just don't want to worry too much about it. When I was researching this, some people were saying that it's ultra processed, which is not true.
No.
The reasons why tinned corn is great... They're obviously picked at peak freshness.
Oh, yeah.
When you buy tinned corn, that sweet corn has been picked, processed very quickly. It's in the tin by the end of the day.
Well, this is what Jack said in the peas episode, the idea of boiling a pan of water in a field of corn so that you can bend the sheaf over.
Yes, I remember.
Cut it straight off, which we will try one day. Like, we will go out and do that.
Who's got a cornfield we can go and cook in?
Actually, genuinely write in and we'll come and can we come and eat one corn?
Yeah.
One ear.
It's minimally processed for what it is. In canned corn, you will almost always have added salt and added sugar.
Right.
But those are the only additives used in that process. One thing I should say about canned corn is that it is a little bit more wet because it's been boiled.
Yeah.
So it's really hard to like dry that out. Whereas like a fresh corn that you've taken off the cob, that's much easier to cook and fry and get kind of like sautéed. Mm.
And you don't get the shape as well. That's the thing. You don't get the
corn. You don't get the shape. And you don't get the satisfaction of gnawing on something like a squirrel. It's also such a funny thing because I feel like as kids, it was such a treat when we got corn on the cob.
Was it?
Because I would like put a knife load of butter for every mouthful.
It makes you really appreciate butter in the same way that I think like a crumpet or a muffin makes you really like, oh my God, butter is incredible.
Yeah, and it was like, if I'd got a dry bite of corn on the cob, I'd be like, no, no, I need my buttery bit back on.
That would be the best way of doing it, I think. A flat tray of melted butter that you can roll your corn cob in the center of the
table.
Like
a paint roller.
Yeah, that's a
great idea.
Like we should just buy table, just put sweet corn on, roll it in the butter.
Yes, restaurants.
That's amazing.
Take note, that's how to serve your corn. Coming up next on Lunchbox Envy, it's Jack with his delicious second lunchbox of the day. What is it?
It's not Babe Station.
You said I had a good M&S voice. I thought I'd bring it. I thought I'd slip it in a couple more times.
This is not just a fact-based food podcast.
Not to let me bring it out.
Oh, yeah.
Mm.
Oh, God.
Oh, my gosh.
Swamp water?
Absolutely cursed.
So I've brought you guys chicha, which is a pre-Columbian South American... fermented corn drink, basically, and it's slightly alcoholic.
Guys, there are three different layers of sediment in this drink.
This looks like if Thames Water did orange juice.
Oh my God.
I haven't made this right, so I should apologise to all the indigenous people of South America for whom this is a very important and loved drink.
Yeah, we should have put an apology right at the top of the show, really, for everything, for the pronunciations.
It's been made for centuries by the pre-Columbian populations of South America. Like I say, it's still popular in Colombia and Peru. And it's traditionally made by chewing corn and spitting it out into a big earthenware box to dry, and then it ferments. And at some point you boil it to get rid of the germs. And it basically turns into a very weak version of beer. It's like sort of 1-2% alcoholic.
We're back to our
Irish
porridge.
Did you chew the corn that's in there?
I did. I chewed out some sweet corn and spat it out. And I also put in like teaspoons of coarse cornmeal.
Yeah, I can see. It doesn't look like teaspoons. It's like several tablespoons.
There were a lot of them. And then it really dried your mouth out. It was like the cinnamon challenge.
Oh, no.
Once you've chewed up this ball, you have a rudimentary malt, which is, as we remember from our beer episode, the basic starting point of a beer. Except
terrible combo.
Beer, you usually use wheat and barley.
Rudimentary malt.
The spitting is important because the amylase in one's saliva, it's an enzyme, and that breaks down the starch into sugars, which the natural yeast feed off to make alcohol. The Inca absolutely relished it from sort of 1400s. I mean, they spanned a long time, but their civilization fell apart when the conquistadors arrived, but it was basically modern day
Peru. And they
were
like, how are you making your beers?
I mean, was there, like, what a job? Your job is a professional corn chewer and spitter.
Yeah, I think so.
You just sat by a pot chewing and spitting out corn. Surely that shift work that would probably really take it out of you, because your jaw would be so sore, you'd have to swap in every hour or so.
That's true. I don't think one person, I think you sort of sit around as a communal experiment and
you just all kind of contribute when you can.
Corn and spit into
quite
the
easy
pole.
To scrape a little bit off the top and work though. Your supervisor would be like, did you just swallow a bit?
Anyway, the Inca absolutely loved it. Supposedly, this is their story, is the origin story. It was discovered by accident, and of course, everything is. Some heavy rain destroyed the grain crop, and everyone was a bit distraught, and they sort of left the grain there to eventually ferment. And then a very hungry man turned up and was like, you know what? I'm hungry enough. I'll try this stuff.
It's a literal miracle. And I'll ruin this, turn into beer.
Yeah, exactly. And he enjoyed it and also got a little bit drunk. And he was like, this stuff's great. And yeah, apparently, when the Spanish arrived, the Inca Atahualpa.
Yes. So he was a very... I've listened to a long The Rest is History series on this. Very good. Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen.
Well, you can fill in the gaps. Who's the Inca leader, was he?
Yes, he was.
He offered a Dominican priest a glass made of gold full of chicha, intended as a sort of icebreaker. You know, he wanted to start a conversation. It was tradition amongst the ancient Peruvians. And the cleric thought...
So invading forces arrive and then there's an awkward silence. And then there's, can I get anyone a drink? At the dawn of time.
Anyway, the cleric thought they were trying to poison him, so he discarded the content, and the rest is history.
The rest is literally history. Yeah. Well, yeah, that would have pissed them off.
It was shunned by the Spanish when they invaded, because they thought it was a bit icky to, like, make stuff with spit.
Which I've got to say, I'm sort of on the same page.
How culturally insensitive of you, Rosie.
You're going to be cancelled. But yeah, it does remain popular in places like Colombia and Peru. And actually, in the 20th century... it was still popular enough that there were chicheros who would make this stuff. And then the Colombian government passed a bill that was mandating that fermented drinks be industrially made and sold in glass containers, which was basically a sideways fuck you to the chicha makers, right? Because they were much more keen on Europeanizing and modernizing. And so they were all drinking beautiful, clean German beer from the new brewery that opened in Bogota. It was kind of racist. They basically saw it as stamping out a dirty indigenous cultural artifact. But yeah, government advertisements put on beer bottles, in fact, would often show babies drinking healthy beer and with the words no más chicha, which is no more chicha.
Wow.
They invented a pseudo-scientific disease called chichismo,
which to get rid of it.
Supposedly was worse than alcoholism. Blamed it for poor hygiene, violence.
My gosh.
Yeah, it was a real concerted campaign to stamp this thing out. So I'm glad it still exists. So it's in the Arc of Taste, which we've mentioned before.
Oh, the Arc of Taste.
The Arc of Taste?
Maybe you weren't here for that one.
I don't think it was. Talk to me about it.
It's basically an organization that documents foods and drinks that are culturally important and in danger of being lost, basically. So it
tries to have them revived in some kind of sustainable way. Rather than it's not like getting a load of seeds and putting them in a box. It's actually trying to get to build an industry back.
You can find non-alcoholic versions that are industrially produced everywhere in South America.
Without spit.
Without spit, yes, that's the thing.
Sans sa spit. It's like orangina.
Right. What a joy that I didn't have to drink Jack's spit. Let's move on to our third and final lunchbox, and that's from you, Alex, today.
I have brought you some popcorn.
Hey. Yummy. Oh my God, it smells so good. I'm going to go.
Seasoned with my own spit. No, I'm
joking. Oh, I love it. Sweet and salty. My fave.
Yeah.
What brand is this? It's excellent.
The pink. I think it's Tesco's own brand, I will say.
Oh my God, I might get some on my way home. I didn't know that there was a special kind that popped.
Yeah, so there's a variety of corn known as popcorn, which gets popped.
Clues in the name.
Crazy.
So, goes back a long way. Pretty much the same as all the other corns, actually.
Columbus.
Surely popped corn was an accident. Like, you accidentally left your corn on top of your boiling hot
and got a horrible fright. Yeah. My food
or,
is exploding.
There's a fire in a cornfield.
Yes, and which suddenly smelled absolutely delicious. And can you imagine the size of that pile of popcorn?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, first of all, I'll talk about why they pop. So, you know what they look like when they're not popped. They all contain a little bit of water and also quite a lot of starch.
Yeah.
And so when heated, the water turns to steam and the pressure builds. And then when it exceeds about 135 PSI, so...
What's KSI just for
PSI.
Pounds per square inch.
Yeah, a measure of pressure.
Right.
It's a lot of pressure. That happens at about 180 degrees Celsius.
Okay.
And the hole suddenly raptures,
ascends to heaven.
In a way,
a fluffy cloud,
It suddenly ruptures and the starch gelatinizes and expands very fast into this kind of foam. And the pop is the sound of the hole bursting. So that is what happens when a kernel of popcorn pops.
Have you seen it in slow motion?
Yes, it's amazing. It's
super slow.
It sort of unfolds. It's a bit like a raft,
an inflatable dinghy. Yeah.
And it expands to about 40 or 50 times its reach. Which I wonder whether...
Crazy.
Is that going to be the biggest ratio of a cooked to uncooked size change in a food?
Definitely.
Can you think of anything that gets way bigger or way smaller?
Spinach.
Bread actually gets quite a lot bigger.
Spinach is quite good.
This is spinach goes the other way. Imagine if you did spinach and popcorn in the same pan.
I was thinking, yeah, that would be a terrible MasterChef round. Is like you have to try and create a dish that like breaks even with cooking.
Yeah.
So like some foods get bigger, some foods get smaller.
The same
and the change in net weight,
and after.
The closer you are to zero. Yeah, you're right.
But surely if you try to cook spinach and popcorn in the same pan, the liquid from the spinach would affect the popped corn.
Yeah, it's all right. It was just a little funny thought experiment, Rosie. Actually, the food science wouldn't work out on that one. There is a special name for the unpopped kernels.
Oh yeah, I read this.
What is it?
You're not going to like it. Old maids or spinsters.
Yeah, same. I've got the same too.
Misogyny at work.
Yeah, because they just they haven't popped like all the other girls.
Different times.
Yeah. In Chile, popcorn is called cabritas. Cabritas means little goats in Spanish, and that's because like the corn jumps like little goats in the pan when you cook it. Isn't
that's
that sweet?
Really sweet.
Yeah. There are a few different types that are used commercially.
Yeah.
They pop in different ways. So one's like a mushroom explosion, which is like, and it comes out very round. And that's good for things like caramel, because like it's a large, like flat surface or round surface for grabbing caramel. Then there's the butterfly snowflake version, which is much better for butter and salt because it's got lots of little nooks and crevices. So look, here, I've got some side by side here. There is some of the butterfly popcorn, which is the sweet and salty version. And you can see that it's very, like, ununiform. It's got those little cavy bits.
Yeah.
And then here is some butter-kissed caramel-coated popcorn, which looks like little woodlice.
Cool.
It's got a little shell and is coated very nicely and evenly in caramel.
Amazing.
And I've never noticed that before.
No,
I've never
had them together. Today, I was today years old when I learned. Did you know the Aztecs used popcorn as necklaces? They'd string them together to make a little garland.
Oh.
And actually, I don't know how popular it is, but I read that it's still contemporary Americans will use it as a way you would use tinsel for like Christmas
decorations. Yeah, I've definitely seen that. That's like quite like, it's a bit like paper chains.
Yeah,
it's quite
like
a
lo-fi
like, traditional way to make Christmas decorations in like the 80s.
Yeah.
Or maybe the 50s.
Like when you go to the cinema, what's your order and how big? What are we talking?
I confess, I don't ever buy popcorn.
Yeah, I could have guessed that.
You are such a saver.
I'll just sit outside and read a book. I usually go for sweet and salty.
So where did the link between cinemas and popcorn come from?
Thank you very much. That was the next thing in my notes. Very nicely linked.
The next thing in my notes as well.
It became associated with cinemas in America during the Great Depression.
And
that's because pretty much everyone was poor and they couldn't really afford any luxuries. And actually popcorn was a very cheap luxury. It was a treat, but it didn't cost very much. So there was a bit of a boom in popcorn production.
Yeah.
Actually, movie theater owners really resisted it at first and like banned it. You had to eat it outside before you came in because you didn't really allow food in.
Yeah, because wasn't the cinema scene as like, it's almost like going to the opera today. It was much more for the upper classes. And actually it came hand in hand with the talkies as well, which came in around the 1930s. Yes. It basically democratized cinema because you didn't need to be literate anymore. You could listen to the people speaking. So it got a lot more poorer, less educated people in.
Yes, it is a noisy food to eat, which a lot of people say it's not really cinema. But I think also it's quieter than talking. Yes. So like everyone's eating popcorn in the cinema.
As I have said. Just been doing for the last 10 minutes.
Filmgoers apparently consume 55% more popcorn if they're watching a sad film compared to a comedy.
Oh, interesting.
Maybe you salt the popcorn more with your tears.
I think so probably it's more that thing of like, if I'm eating, I'm not crying. Like, you know.
Also, if you're laughing.
That is how I get through life.
Also, if you're laughing, you're not eating.
Yes, that's
maybe
true.
That's why it is. Yeah.
True.
Have you guys been to cinema in America?
Yes.
Yes, but years and years and years ago.
Yeah. Do you remember? I'm not sure it's ubiquitous, but it seemed it because my American companion at the time was like, oh yeah, that's just the butter tap. They've got butter taps. And you basically put your popcorn underneath and you press a button and it just, a spout of liquid butter comes out. And then you just sort of like...
It's like a water dispenser, but for butter.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
crazy.
Yeah. But honestly, it wasn't nice butter and there was splashback everywhere.
Oh yeah, no, it's like
margarine. And also your hand, because actually one of the good things about popcorn is that you don't have like super greasy hands after you eat it. Yeah.
There was a brand of popcorn called Zits in the 1920s.
Gross.
I know, it's funny these words that get connotations later. Yeah.
But I suppose maybe Zit is slang for like a little kind of bobbly thing, which people were then on
their that was it, but that came after. Yeah. So the Zits, the brand came first.
When they come back from the summer break and there's a board meeting, they're like, guys, bad news. There's new slang in town.
We can't call it Zits.
We are now the face of pustules.
Have you guys ever had anything that's been flavoured with pandan leaves?
Oh, yes, I think so.
They taste like popcorn.
Do they?
Oh.
Like if you soak pandan leaves in milk, it's quite a popcorny flavour.
Oh, interesting.
I'm going to come back to that. Okay, interesting. I also found something while I was looking at popcorn. There's an animal that smells like popcorn.
Oh, I think I've... Ah, what is it? Ah, I've come across this.
It's all right, I've got it written down. I can just tell you.
No, I know, but I'm a quizzer.
Go on then.
It's like a Southeast Asian mammal.
Yes. It's a member of the civet family.
Yeah, civets. Yes. Okay. It's a bandicoot.
Very close. It's a binturong.
Binturong.
Also known as a bear cat, although it is neither a bear nor a cat.
Great name.
Probably named by an Australian. Yeah. And it produces this compound, I think in its urine, called 2-acetyl-1-pyrrolidine.
Okay.
Oh my God, my fave.
Well, it is because it's the molecule that gives off the smell of cooked popcorn.
Love it.
And it was two researchers in 2016 at Duke University and Hendricks College that worked out the chemical that the animal produces. But it's a bit of a mystery because in order to like make this chemical, you sort of need a temperature above what animals can make in their bodies.
Really?
So they can't really work out how this animal is making it. They think it might be something to do with it's reacting with some kind of external bacteria or something. But it's a little
That's
bit of
crazy.
A
shortcut.
I think bear cat mystery. Binturong like cartoon for kids would be a really great like theme, you know.
Well,
like,
maybe this a mascot for popcorn, bear cat popcorn.
Yeah,
yeah. Bear cat popcorn.
A little bear cat peeing on your popcorn.
Yeah. Right. That is it for this week's edition of Lunchbox Envy.
You can follow our socials for foodie facts and podcast updates. We are on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram and TikTok at Lunchbox Envy Pod.
You can also get in touch and send us your facts, recipes, questions or suggestions for future topics by emailing us lunchbox@qi.com.
Rosie, any final corny recipes?
Yes, actually, I do have a recipe on my Substack newsletter, The Dinner Party. I made a thing which I called creamed corn mash, which is basically a hybrid of creamed corn and mash. And it is sensational.
Beige AF.
It's beige AF. Well, no, because obviously I made it look beautiful. So like there's spring onions and toasted corn on top.
Okay.
But the mash itself is a combination of buttery mashed potato with creamy corn, ooh, cheese, parmesan, a few spices.
Any mayo?
Not this time, but I do think it would go great with some mayo. But I served it with
a drink, maybe.
Yeah.
A chaser.
I served it with some grilled bavette, and it's a fantastic side for steak or any kind of meat dish if you like.
Sounds amazing.
Incredible.
Let me check that out.
Before we wrap up today, I just wanted to say a special hello to one of our newest followers and we hope listeners,
Oh, yes. Chrissy Teigen.
Chrissy Teigen followed us on Instagram this week.
Huge milestone for the podcast.
We just feel very pleased. If you think you're more famous than Chrissy Teigen and you also listen to Lunchbox every week, do let us know. We'd love to shout you out.
I bet Chrissy Teigen stops following us after she hears this.
We will see you next week. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Lunchbox Envy was hosted by Jack Chambers, Alex Bell, and me, Rosie McKean. It was produced by Alex Bell. This has been a quite interesting podcast.